thanks very much. You forgot to say that. So I was an undergrad here, I was going to say a few words at the beginning about that wandering path. I sort of had a random walk path, obviously. And I think that there's a tendency, especially when you're an undergrad, to assume that the only true path is that you stick with it all the way. And that's not true. There's an amazing record of people who've gone from physics to do the kind of stuff I do. One thing I've realized as I've done this is all sorts of the people who are my mentors actually left physics and did this, but some of them left more like in the 60s or 70s. In fact, a bunch of the core of the sort of science policy establishment who's really done some of the best thinking about stuff at the interface between science, policy, and technology have been physicists. And I think that really came out of the war. It came out of the fact that after the war, after the bomb project, a lot of the people who worked on that project became involved really with both hands in the middle of science policy, and that's stayed with us till the present day. And so, in fact, when I got to Carnegie Mellon, which has really been my intellectual center, and still is in many ways, that group of people who are one of the two or three most successful groups that does sort of interdisciplinary technology and public policy, about a third or half of us are physicists by training, I think. So I went through here as undergraduate. Actually, to be honest, had a bit of a rough time here as an undergrad, but they didn't even accept me to grad school here, even though I won the first prize and the CAP prize. But then I had a really fun time at MIT, and then I wandered off to do this stuff, and I was, Dick Pelletier was asking me why I did that, and I think at the time that I really stepped away from doing the physics I did, you know, physics into atmospheric science at MIT, there were really two things that interested me. One is it's really fun to work on problems that are really connect the real world, and the other one is, and I now know that I could be doing this in physics, so I could have stayed in physics, but at least the part of physics I was at, I seemed to be working on problems where we were getting things to the, you know, 10th significant digit. And I really enjoyed the fact that atmospheric science, there's all these factor of two or even order of magnitude problems lying around, and I enjoyed that aspect a lot. But now I'll plunge into this. I actually recently spent not as much time as you might think on this topic, but well, let me get to number one. Let me jump in. I'm going to start by trying to frame the reason you'd think about managing the climate risk in such an extraordinary way as engineering the whole climate. And I'll spend a good 10 minutes or so, and actually I don't have a watch, so give me a 10-minute warning or something, about the framing of that problem. And I guess I want to start by saying the following. The climate sensitivity, the amount the climate might change, warm up, when we perturb it, say by putting CO2 in the atmosphere, the accuracy with which we know that number is at best a factor of 2 or 3. There's still enormous uncertainty in how much the climate will change, and that uncertainty is essentially not decreased over time. So just to give you a sense of that, a nice pictorial way to think about it that the MIT group has come up with is think about some kind of roulette wheel, and so there is a real chance that we could end up with climate changes below 1°C. It's a small chance, but it's real. And there's a real chance they could be over 5°C. And the difference between that is basically between this being not a serious problem. I mean, in Canada, there'd probably be the winners would probably outnumber the losers if we only had 1°C global. And 5°C, which would really be stunning. 5°C would almost certainly, if it was sustained, really accelerate loss of the big ice sheets, for example. And we really don't know where it is. Here's an example of estimates of climate sensitivity. Here's an estimate that we did by asking a bunch of experts back in the early mid-90s, or the work was done in the early 90s. And I think a key thing we did, these were 8-hour-long, very structured interviews where we tried to get probability distributions from experts about a bunch of things related to climate change. And one of the things we did is we, at the end of that, said, let's assume that you were made czar. We asked them about allocating research dollars, essentially, across different subfields in climate. And at the end, we said, let's assume you were made czar of the U.S. climate program, and everything you just told us happened, and we came back to your office 20 years later and asked you by what amount your uncertainty band has decreased. And the answer is, most of them said it wouldn't decrease much, which is, in fact, what's happened. It's now almost 20 years later, and that's the reality. That's not because people aren't working very hard and very smart, but it's because the problem is hard. And this is one clue about why the problem is hard, which this is one of these papers that's so simple, you think, why didn't I write this paper? And it's not a perfect paper, but it really gets at the underlying reason, I think, why it is so hard to nail climate sensitivity. So climate sensitivity has to do with feedbacks. there's a whole bunch of different feedbacks, ice, albedo, and water vapor, and you can write a list of hundreds of these feedbacks. And one not correct but not crazy way to think about it is assume that each of these feedbacks is sort of normally distributed, the uncertainty in it. And if you sum them all up, you have some normal distribution of the feedback factor, but that makes the climate sensitivity have a long, fat tail. And it makes it very, very hard to make progress in understanding what the climate sensitivity is. I think that's a simple version of the underlying reason why this problem is so hard. And so we cannot think about solving the problem by waiting until we know what the answer is to act. We must, the way we talk about this, the Carnegie Mellon Group, is to say that this is an irreducible uncertainty. We have to think about making decisions about climate change, living with the fact that the uncertainty is pretty fundamental to the problem. We're not really going to see where we land on this thing until we've actually changed the climate enough to see what's happening, which is 50 plus years out. Give you a sense of how bad the tails are. These are various fits to various of these priors using the fit function that comes out of Gary and Jared and Marcy's paper. And I've just expressed here, I don't necessarily believe these numbers very much, but I believe it in order of magnitude. I've expressed the probability that the temperature change is bigger than 8 degrees. 8 degrees is horrific. And the probabilities are sort of order a few percent to 10%. The point is they're not 0.001%. I don't really care whether they're 3 or 10. That's a big number. The other thing that's important to say is there's an enormous inertia in our system. So if one day we convince our politicians to really act, that doesn't mean the problem's solved. There's an enormous delay between acting and doing anything. So let's say you turn the wheel of policy, you enact some carbon tax or whatever it happens to be. So that means that people start, at that point, businesses start building more low emissions infrastructure after some time delay when it takes them a long time to get infrastructure sited. And then the emissions reductions grow as the integral of this infrastructure build rate. But that's just the emissions. Atmosphere doesn't care on a given day about emissions. It cares about concentrations, about how much CO2 is in the air. And the concentration reduction grows as basically the integral of the emissions. And then you've got ocean heat delay. And the net effect is you've got this gigantic inertia in the system. So you have a system both with very big uncertainty and very big inertia. And if you think about this from a control theory point of view, these are hard systems to control. That's really why this problem is dangerous. By the time you find out how bad the climate sensitivity is, you may turn out to be lucky and it'll be low, or you may turn out that it'll be high. But if you find out that it's high in 2030, you can't suddenly say, oh, I'm going to spend 5% of GDP to make the problem go away. You just can't. There's too much uncertainty in the system. And I think that's the underlying reason to think about the topic I'm going to mostly talk about, which is how you'd engineer the climate. And in my view, one of the reasons that a lot of us worry about giving public talks or writing op-eds or whatever about engineering the climate is that it's very cheap to cool the climate. We can give you an ice age for about 0.01% of GDP. It's not hard to do. It will not compensate for doubling CO2, but it's easy. And people naturally tend to think that because it's easy, even though it doesn't necessarily work for the things we actually want it to do, that it could protect us from the climate risk. And so there's a tendency to think we should do less mitigation, less cutting emissions, because we have this. And I think that's really not the right thing. But one of the reasons I talk about this kind of inertia uncertainty problem is the point is, even if we did our best today cutting emissions, we'd still have a problem. One way to say that is we had this meeting that Dan Schrag on the upper left here and I organized at Harvard on geoengineering last fall. And a high point of the meeting for me was a big argument between Rob Sokolow, who some of you may know from the Wedges paper, that is one of the papers that's like changed the whole world's thinking about how to cut CO2 emissions, and what's his name from IPCC at Harvard, whose name I'm forgetting, sorry, somebody in the audience will know it, Jim McCarthy, was about whether we're making any progress. With Rob arguing that we were really making progress because politicians are paying attention, we're passing laws and so on, and Jim saying, you know, look at the actual results. No hardware is getting built. And that argument was really interesting. I don't know which version I believe with. It depends on which side of the bed I get up on. But the point is, it doesn't matter which of those arguments are right. We still might have enough CO2 in the atmosphere today that we're in trouble. This is a slide that supports the view that we're not making much progress. Despite all the talk, all the, you know, if you just sort of tune into the news these days, you hear analysts talk about climate change. During all the time we've negotiated all these treaties, Framework Convention of Kyoto, the rate of growth of emissions has gone up from a little over 1% a year to 3% a year. There is nothing discernible in the global emissions rate that in any way suggests we're doing anything on this problem at all. And it's also important to say that We've known about this problem for a very, very long time. Again, some of you who don't do this professionally, and all of you who are professional geoscientists know all this, might kind of think that we first really found out about the climate problem maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And that really isn't true. Here's a New York Times article, just like all the ones you read every day today, and it says actually about the same stuff as the New York Times articles you read today. It has more or less the right physics about the amount of CO2 in the air and what's going on and how it might melt the glaciers, and it's written in 1953. That paper was reporting on Gilbert Plass's first high-quality radio transfer algorithms he built for the U.S. Air Force that really, you know, built into the first... was before modern general circulation models, but it was the beginning of accurate ability to calculate the radiative impacts of CO2 in the air. We've known this for a long time. The first high-level presidential document that laid out the modern climate problem in all its detail to the U.S. president, you know, the most powerful politician on the earth still, maybe not for much longer, that was when I was 2 years old in 1965 to President Johnson. It's a long time since 1965, and we really have done nothing. I mean, not quite nothing, but epsilon. So here's a way to think about the climate system, and here's a way to name the things we might do about it, just to get our words straight. So mitigation is reducing our climate forcing, reducing the amount of CO2 we put in the air or other things we do that changes the climate. Adaptation is getting used to it, you know, putting more air conditioners in or what have you. And geoengineering are things we do to break the link in between those two. This isn't about what's good or bad, it's just about what it's called. It is pretty clear, although it's actually this figure isn't as good as it could be to make it clear, that putting a lot of reflective particles in the upper atmosphere cools the climate down, and it does it fast. This is pretty simple physics. You put less heat into the system, and it gets colder. And we know that from these two big volcanoes. This figure gives it to you a little bit better. These volcanoes that put many megatons of sulfur into the stratosphere, that sulfur does many things, including things atmospheric chemistry. But what one thing it does is simply reflects away a lot of sunlight, and it cools the planet. And the big thing to say is that this happens very fast. Unlike all the things that we should do and aren't really doing about cutting emissions, which are slow for all the reasons I said because of all these time delays, things that you do to cut the amount of sunlight happen quickly because they operate on the direct radiative balance, not indirectly through the carbon cycle. But of course, you would not expect, and you do not, or we should not expect to have the same climate if we increase CO2 and then turn down the sun. It's clear that if you increase CO2 a certain amount, that there is, you could turn down the sun to a point where you got back to the same globally average surface temperature. It has to be true. Curves have to cross in that sense. But you will not end up with the same climate. You may end up with a lot less ozone. You may end up with a tropical monsoon that looks different. You will probably end up with less tropical precipitation. There are a lot of ways in which you'll end up with a different climate. So you are really wrong to think of this as a perfect compensation for putting CO2 in the air, but it still might reduce the overall climate risk. Let me just give you a sense of the numbers here. And really, the big number, if you want to look at one number, is that 1 to 300,000 ratio, which is actually quite uncertain, but it gives you a sense of the number. Putting 1 gram of sulfur in the stratosphere roughly offsets 300,000 grams of carbon put in the atmosphere in terms of its direct radiative forcing. That's why there's a lot of leverage. That's why you can do this. So you might, for example, think, oh, if I put sulfur in the stratosphere, won't that contribute to acid rain? And the answer is yes, but the quantities are much smaller. So right now, humans put about 50 megatons of sulfur a year into the atmosphere through mostly their coal-fired power plants that causes local air pollution, especially in East Asia. And the amount of sulfur it would take to cool the planet by several degrees are sort of order 1 or 2 megatons, so a few percent. How would you get it up there? Naval guns is something that the US National Academy considered pretty seriously in an Academy report in the early 1990s, and actually I was part of a study group of people who looked at this pretty hard a few weeks ago, a group that grows out of the U.S. JASON program, which are advisors to the Defense Department, but we had people who actually knew about naval guns, and this is still actually not a crazy way to do it. A naval gun will lift at 1-ton payloads to the lower stratosphere at costs that are pretty reasonable, but there are a bunch of other ways we might do it that might actually work better than that. So far, mostly what we thought about doing is putting sulfur in the stratosphere because sulfur is what nature does. But I'm going to tell you about things that might be engineered, that might be more than what nature does, which might or might not be better or worse. First, I want to say that it's not obvious, as I said, that the compensation will be very good. That is, if I increase CO2 by, say, enough to double CO2, which warms the planet a few degrees C, then I decrease the amount of sunlight to bring the planet back to having the same globally average surface temperature, you might expect the climate to look very different. And indeed, these simulations that Ken Caldera did grew out of a meeting that we had about 10 years ago where some folks from Lawrence Livermore were very proudly telling us how geoengineering would solve everything. In fact, this was Lowell Wood, one of the people who brought you Star Wars and atomic bombs. And Lowell was very, very confident about this, and he doesn't know much about atmospheric science. A bunch of us in the back of the room stood up and said, you don't know what you're talking about. The climate will look very different. And Ken went home and ran a bunch of climate runs to try and prove Lowell wrong, and in fact found more or less the opposite, that the compensation is very, very good. And that's now been borne out by a bunch of different climate models. So looking at that bottom panel, this is a relatively primitive model, and I'm going to actually skip some of this for those of you who aren't atmospheric models, but this is a more real state-of-the-art atmospheric model where it actually has an atmospheric sulfur cycle in the stratosphere. And Phil Rash ran this one, and the answer is about the same. The compensation is remarkably good. So better than we expected, but not perfectly, the climate returns towards near its its original value if you increase CO2 and then decrease the sunlight. And there's some interesting science behind why that happens. But I'm not going to go into it now. I'm happy to answer questions about it. I'll tell you a little bit about thinking about what you would do to do better than sulfur. There are various things that are bad about sulfur. It falls out of the stratosphere quickly. Solid particles like sulfur in the stratosphere have a catalytic effect in turning chlorine from a non-reactive form called chlorine nitrate to a reactive form which accelerates ozone depletion. This chlorine is chlorine we put in through chlorofluorocarbons, and so that can be a problem. There are quite a number of other things that are not nice about sulfur. One of them is that sulfur particles forward scatter a lot. If you think about me scattering, those of you who have some optics, a sort of micron scale or more like a third of a micron scale sulfur particle, a lot of the scattering is forward scattering. So you tend to increase the ratio of diffuse to direct sunlight quite a bit. And in fact, that effect is much bigger in ratio terms. The forward scattering ratio is high. So that's a big effect, which might potentially make the sky look more milky, which is something that's not very nice. It might actually make plants grow quicker. In fact, there's evidence that happened after both volcanoes. Because if you think about a pattern of leaves shade each other. And if you have more diffuse sunlight, you actually get more efficient photosynthesis. And I'm not just making that up. There's both theory and data suggest that that's true. I started thinking at one point about whether you could do better. And I literally was sort of lying in bed at night and thinking about these things and about the physics that makes them go and about whether small particles in the upper atmosphere could exploit that physics. And the next day, I started to calculate this from first principles, which was fun because I don't do that very much anymore, and I'm really going back to stuff I learned when I was here in Toronto. And I was trying to think about what happens if you have unequally heated particles in the atmosphere, and I got stuck because it's hard to calculate. But actually, it turns out there's a whole host of papers about this. It's called photophoresis, and it was discovered in the 1910 or something. It's the first Ehrenschaft paper. I forget the date. And there's now a whole host of papers. It turns out this is quite an important thing in astrophysics. I'll tell you what it is. This is the simplest version of it that is quite important for astrophysical, for interstellar disks. It turns out not to be very important in the Earth's atmosphere, but it's the easiest thing to explain. And after this, I'll tell you the more real one that matters. So assume I have some particle, and the particle's living in a place where the mean free path of the air molecules is a lot bigger than the particle. So just think of these things as ballistic particles. And I heat one side of the particle more than the other by radiation, then there's going to be a force away from the hot side because the particles bouncing off the hot side will come bounce off with more thermal energy, more kinetic energy than the particles bouncing off the cold side. Simple enough. And this apparently is actually quite important. You Google photophoresis and you get a whole host of astrophysical papers. This appears to be what matters more in the Earth's atmosphere. So there's a fact called the molecular accommodation coefficient. You might think, I would have thought, that if a particle bounces off a surface, it will thermally equilibrate with the surface. It's not true. That is, the vibrational modes in the particle will feel the heat of the surface. Uh-uh. It turns out there's a probability of that happening that goes between 0 and 1, and it depends. I mean, obviously, there are you could imagine calculating this from first principles, and I expect there are people who do, but experimentally, there's just a range of values depending on what the gas atom is and what the surface is, and that range is pretty big. So it's easy to get very different molecular accommodation coefficients. That's the kind of old 19th century physics name for this thing. And so let's say you had a particle that was isothermal, and it had something to make it settle in one direction. So it had a center of gravity that was offset from the center of drag. And let's say that the particle had, let's say on the lower side, a higher accommodation coefficient than the upper side. Then the particle would have a body-centered force that was upwards all the time. And so it would be levitated. It would be a levitated particle. And it appears that this happens. That was the paper I flashed by you. It appears that this actually happens in the real atmosphere and may explain a layer of dust that we see at about 100 kilometers up, and I'll actually tell you why it's 100 kilometers in a second. So think about a little particle like this. I've got to have one equation. This is a physics audience. So this force is basically proportional to the temperature difference between the particle and the surrounding gas and the pressure. And so you might think that this force would fall off very, very quickly. Remember, the pressure is falling off by, you know, 1 over E every scale height, which is 8 kilometers or so, less than the atmosphere. And so you might think this force would vary enormously over the height of the atmosphere, but it doesn't. Because while P is varying a huge amount, delta T is varying a lot too. Because what's determining delta T, the difference between the temperature of the particle and the surrounding gas? Well, the particle's being heated radiatively, right? It's got some solar input, some radiative heating, and maybe it's got some long wave heating from the Earth as well. And it's getting rid of its heat maybe by radiative cooling, but certainly by conduction. And it turns out through almost all the atmosphere until I get up to about 100 kilometers, the conductive cooling dominates the radiative cooling. And so, the delta T depends on pressure, and or depends on 1 over pressure, and the force depends on 1 over T, so I get a compensation. And in fact, the lifting force is about roughly constant, even though the pressure varies by 4 orders of magnitude, up till you get to this decoupling at about 100 kilometers. This says stuff about particle size, which I'll skip over. So that's all very nice, but let's say I have this little particle like that. It's got Brownian torques. So I told you the particle had a heavier part, but of course it's getting bombarded by Brownian motion all the time. That's the sky that slipped over. It's got Brownian torques, and it'll tend to be randomized. And it turns out that as you make very small particles, that can overwhelm it. So it has a body-centered force, but the vector of that body-centered force is wiggling all around, so there's no net force. But there are several other things you could do to break symmetry and orient particles in the atmosphere. You don't have to rely on gravitation. And so the stuff that I've thought about is, what if you had a sphere that was, say, magnetic? And or you could have a sphere that had an electret in it, because the Earth has not just a magnetic field, but roughly everywhere in the atmosphere has a couple hundred volts per square meter electric field. And it turns out that common ferroelectrics or carbon magnetic materials easily have much more restoring torque than a reasonably eccentric body. So you can easily levitate, it turns out, particles with much larger forces and levitate particles with odd shapes, in principle. Nobody's done this in practice. So here's a conceptual design. This is not a real object. This is just kind of a first cut joke, but it's an interesting thing to think about. It's a thought experiment. So you can make a little thing. I mean, basically, this is a flying saucer. I can tell you how to make flying saucers that work. They're just very small. So it's a flying saucer that maybe has a radius of 10 microns or so, and it's made of a sandwich. So it has a layer of barium titanate, which is an electret. And you might think, is that too small to make an electric work? But it turns out there's hundreds of papers on this because people are spending a lot of time working on electrets for specialized kinds of memory chips nowadays. So you can definitely make them, and it's even quite a cheap bulk material, and there's methods of doing this processing that are relatively cheap. And you have a layer of aluminum, and ideally you set the layer of aluminum to a thickness which is infrared transmissive but solar reflective, and that's easy to do. It happens automatically. And then this disk can be arranged to have a very strong levitating force upwards, and there are even tricks to allow it to have a little bit of a torque that will make it drift towards the poles, not by actual magnetic attraction to the poles, but because of this torque you've engineered. And this gives you a sense of what the levitating forces on a disk like that might look like. So this is altitude going from the ground to 120 kilometers. That's a levitating force. So levitating force of 1 is the levitating force equal to gravity force, so it's not going up or down. So the point is, a particle that was, say, released here will tend to keep going upwards until it stops right about here, this place where all these forces go to zero here, under the different, these are ratios of the infrared and solar albedos, that place is this place where you get the decoupling, where you are radiative cooling dominated and the force drops to zero. So the particles tend to rest at 100 kilometers. What would be the good of this thing if you could make them? And this is forgetting for a second whether any of this makes any sense, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. Long atmospheric lifetimes might be a benefit, although there's also risk to that because it means you can't stop so easily. But long atmospheric lifetimes means, in principle, the mass flux you would need of these particles would be much, much smaller than with sulfur, which has a short atmospheric lifetime of a couple years. You got the particles out of the stratosphere, so there wouldn't be an ozone impact, at least not directly, but there might be other impacts we haven't thought about yet. There's this potential to concentrate particles near the poles, which is actually one of the really big prizes. If you want to do this ever, exactly what you might want to do is compensate for the ice albedo feedback, the fact that as it warms up at the poles, there's less snow and ice, but mostly snow is the issue here, and that makes the ground is darker, so it absorbs more heat, so there's a strong positive feedback. And that positive feedback is the reason that in essentially all models of climate change, you get more polar warming than warming in the equator. And so concentrating particles near the poles is exactly what you'd want to do, probably, if you wanted some, excuse the uncertainty. There's an argument that says that if you want to do this at all, you'd want to do it near the poles to minimize the impact of middle latitude climates and maximize the impact where the warming of the Earth was worst, and also where we worry most about ice sheet loss. Finally, you know, a particle design like I showed you really doesn't forward scatter, so you can get away from the forward scattering problem, and you could also imagine making particles that were specially selective. So in principle, this gives you another lever for tuning the way you're engineering the Earth's climate. So let me go back to policy for a minute. This is the original document that that President Johnson saw in 1965. And it's sort of interesting that in that document, they got all the modern science right about climate change. They knew about CO2 building up in the Earth's atmosphere and that it was coming from burning fossil fuels, and they had some idea about what it would do to change the climate. But the only thing they suggested doing to change it was these countervailing forces like geoengineering. They didn't even think about actually cutting emissions, and which is a joke. I mean, it shows you the sort of overwhelming techno-optimism of the mid-60s. And it's really bizarre when you go back and read that. And it tells you something about the fact that really, if you look even over 100 years, the stability of the underlying climate science, which in some ways you can date back to the 1890s when the very first calculation of the effect of doubling CO2 in the atmosphere was made, that has been much more stable than our thinking about the problem, about whether it's a good problem or a bad problem. The guy, Svante Arrhenius, who made the calculations in the 1890s, he thought that climate change was a great thing. The guy lived in Sweden, after all, and he speculated about virtuous circles where fossil fuel burning would drive the northern limits of agriculture northwards, and so you could grow more food for a growing population. This topic has been around for a long, long time. That was the point of the last slide. Essentially, nobody talked about it. I wrote occasional review articles, a few other people did. I spent a couple percent of my time on it. Nobody took this that seriously in the kind of mainstream part of the scientific world, really until this paper. And this is in a kind of obscure journal called Climatic Change, and the paper didn't actually say anything new. It was one of those papers where it just matters who says it. Paul Crutzen had won the Nobel Prize for his work on stratospheric chemistry. And one of the concerns people had always had about this was that putting these particles in the stratosphere would deplete ozone. And I think Paul making arguments about why that wasn't necessarily a big idea, and he even has an idea in that paper to compensate for the effect so you'd get actually more ozone, not less, that made this whole thing go crazy. There's endless papers all over it. At this point, you might be thinking about the following thought. You might think, how can this guy talk about controlling the climate? Isn't the climate chaotic somehow? Isn't it uncontrollable? Well, let me just dispel that idea, at least in principle. So yes, chaos is sensitivity to initial conditions, and so you might assume that since weather was chaotic, control is impossible, but of course any of you who really know about this know this is completely not true, the opposite of the truth. That in fact, to control chaotic systems, you need a model that connects the current state to the future state. You need observations of the current state. You need some appropriate leverage to influence the system, and you need feedback. And in fact, there are plenty of places where we build systems, like this aircraft, that are deliberately unstable so we can actually, once we close the loop, control the systems with smaller control inputs than we could, in this case, with a conventional aircraft. There are many, many places in human societies now where we routinely control chaotic systems using feedback loops like this. So just the fact that you can't predict the system's distant evolution says nothing about your ability to control it when you have feedback. And I'll say one more thing that should get your head scratching. We're basically building all the software to do this. So the people who spend their lives trying to do better weather prediction are continuously improving the observations, the forward models, and these analysis forecast systems that merge the two. And collectively, that makes it so that it makes it so that with the same size lever, I should have written this other way, you can get larger and larger level of climate control. And that's going to keep happening over the entire next century, whether or not we put any money at all into geoengineering research. It's just a fact that research in the geosciences, even if it's intended to understand humans' impact on the Earth, or if it's pure science, contributes to our ability to control the Earth in an engineering sense, whether we like it or not, whether we use it or not. It's just a reality of the way humans learn things. So how to think about this? One way to think about it is that you should use geoengineering as a substitute for mitigation. So as the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere grow, we should just keep turning down the sunlight to compensate. I think there's essentially nobody who takes that seriously. I think it's really an untenable position for any number of reasons that I think you can think about yourself. Another way to think about it that is not so easy to dismiss is to say, let's say we work very hard to cut emissions, as I think we should. There's going to come some day, some date, hopefully in your lives, where the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere peaks, because we've done enough to restrain emissions by switching our energy systems so that they don't put CO2 in the air, whether by building solar panels or nuclear power plants or what have you. There will come a day, maybe it's 2073, where the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere peaks. We're already almost 10 years or so past the date where the chlorine concentration in the stratosphere peaked because of the Montreal Protocol, which banned substances that destroy the ozone layer. So imagine that happens. The point is, getting back to the discussion at the beginning, we're going to get to some peak, and we might find that that peak had unacceptable climate change. And so not as a substitute for cutting emissions, but as well as cutting emissions, we might want to, during the period of peak concentrations, reduce the sunlight a little bit to reduce the climate risk. And that's harder to dismiss. But there's a kind of catch there, because of course our knowledge about what we might do in the future is connected to what we do now about cutting emissions. So knowledge that geoengineering is possible, if indeed it is, I wouldn't really claim we know that for sure yet, makes the climate impacts look less fearsome, because we think, well, if the climate impacts are really bad, we can deal with them. And that makes a weaker commitment to cutting emissions now. It's what economists call, it's not quite, but it more or less is what economists call a moral hazard. And that is the central concern that I think before Paul Crutzen's article really stopped anybody talking about this topic at all. My view, which is sort of a reluctant view, I worked on this on and off with probably a few percent of my career time in the last 20 years now, is that we won't make good decisions by just pretending this thing isn't there. For one thing, the climate risk is real. We really don't know the climate sensitivity, and we need to have some answer to what we do if the climate sensitivity ends up on the very high end of the distribution. And also, we're now in a world where there's a great deal of kind of blogospheric interest on this topic and not enough serious people and hard science. And so my view is that at this point we do need some sort of limited, not gigantic research program that is serious on this topic, that gets us out of a few occasional papers published every decade, which is how it's been for most of the last few decades. And a lot of these papers have been really nutty. So another way to say it is that you have to be very sure that climate engineering will never work, or you have to think that the climate risk is very small to conclude that research is not justified, that is the value of that knowledge is not pretty high. If you do a kind of classic economic value of information calculation, the value of knowing whether this is doable is huge. This is the first paper that we published about this in the early 90s, and I think this is still more or less the truth. Current discussions of geoengineering are very unsystematic and take very little account of prior results. It's like every few years somebody writes a paper and they think they thought of something new, but it's not really connected to what happened before. The possibility of unpleasant surprises in the climate system justifies a more coherent, though not large, research program to define a fallback option, a backstop, to make reasonable choices. A rational allocation of research priorities dictates that some resources be spent to study this, unless one assigns these surprises zero probability. So here's some opinions. I think we need a real research program. I think that while we don't know this yet, the current balance of evidence suggests that intelligently executed climate engineering would be less risky than not doing it. I think that geoengineering should be treated as a means of managing the worst outcomes, not as a substitute for cutting emissions. But again, I may say that, everybody else working in this field may say that, but we're not the ones who make the political decisions. The science community should expect to lose control. That's what happens when we invent new technologies. We have some influence over their use, but we don't control them. And I think the real hard questions are, how do we avoid this underlying mitigation geoengineering trade-off? And how do we do the science? Obviously, I'm sort of leaving out the main scientific questions that a lot of us are thinking about. But also, how do we develop some international method for coping with these problems? Thanks very much. I'm happy to take questions and talk about other stuff. Absolutely. So the question is, if you reduce solar insolation, aren't you introducing a whole bunch of other problems? And the answer is obviously yes. And so if you had a choice sitting back in 1850 between having the world you had in 1850 or having a world with 2 times CO2 and less sunlight, you would obviously choose having the world you had in 1850. So I am not saying, and nobody else who's serious about this is saying, that the risks of doing this are zero. The question is, we don't have that choice. It's not 1850 anymore. So we have a certain amount of CO2 in the air, and we cannot, short of having a global war, we cannot stop putting CO2 in the air immediately. There's all these inertia in the system. So even if we did what I spend most of my time telling decision makers we should do, which is work very seriously to cut emissions, we're still going to have a lot of CO2 in the air with unpredictable consequences. And the question is, if we have a certain amount of CO2 in the air, let's just for the sake of argument say 2 times pre-industrial, 550 or so ppm, would the risks to climates, ecosystems, et cetera, to humans, be larger with just 550 ppm of CO2 in the air, or with 550 ppm of CO2 and a megaton of sulfur in the air? And the answer to that question is, we don't know yet. We have to do some real research. Clearly, there will be trade-offs. There isn't one affected entity. So if you live in the high Arctic and you want to drill for oil and gas, you want the Arctic to melt. If you live in the high Arctic and you like hunting polar bears, you don't. And so two such entities might have completely different views about what the risks were. And in practice, that's part of the reason this problem is so hard. I did try and very briefly address the question about sunlight and plants. And the answer is, if you're only shaving off a few percent of the sunlight, that affects crop productivity a lot less than you might think, because crops don't spend that much time being light limited. And there are ways you could actually get around it by doing this scattering thing that makes things grow more. So the question is, what about ocean plant growth? And the answer, although there are people who I think might be more geochemists in the room than me, the answer is that more or less, surprisingly, biology matters a lot less than you think in the oceans, because more or less, it's limited by nutrients. And whatever nitrogen and phosphorus make it to the surface through most of the ocean react. And that thing called the biological pump, well, there's an enormous amount of biological cycling, you can alter the amount of that biological cycling quite a lot in an ocean geochemical model and get almost no CO2 signal. It's quite surprising, and there's several nice papers that say that. So I'm pretty confident that that effect is small, although there's no specific, I mean, this is early days. There's no paper that goes after that effect that I know about.
So we had a question.
Okay, sorry.
And then two more there.
Yep. Yeah, except that one is wrong. So, yeah. So it is true that we will eventually run short of conventional oil. It might even be true that we'll start to see the peaking of conventional oil relatively soon, a few decades. It is not true in the realm of anybody who's sort of part of the normal geoscience community. There are some extreme people. We are not remotely short of fossil fuels. Lowball estimates, not counting methane hydrates, say there's 8 gigatons of carbon of recoverable fossil fuels. To put this in perspective, 8,000 gigatons of carbon. The amount of carbon burned in human history is right now about 500 or so gigatons. And the amount we might burn this century is about 1,000 gigatons. And so the number I'm quoting is 8, and that doesn't include methane hydrates. There is an enormous amount of fossil resources lying around the planet. And in general, they get easier to access. There's some competition between the fact that we use up the easy ones and the fact they get easier to access with our technology. Turning coal into oil is not very hard at prices like this. After all, the Germans ran 80 or 90% of their jet fuel production, a high number, I don't remember, of their jet fuel production was coal to liquids. And that's a long time ago now. At these oil prices, if you knew for sure that there would be no more oil production after 2030, so let's say, you know, the god of oil comes from the skies and says there will be no more conventional oil production after 2030, but we don't change anything else about public policy, what's going to happen? This is a really important question. Is that going to make CO2 emissions smaller or higher? Your natural assumption is it will make CO2 emissions smaller. Because you're cutting off a source of fossil fuels, it's got to be a good thing if you care about the climate. Uh-uh. Opposite. If you cut off cheap conventional oil, people are still going to pay to fill their tanks with hydrocarbons because they want to drive. And what they will do is do coal to liquids. The Chinese are already doing it at a huge scale, and it will just, I mean, if you knew you were going to stop making conventional oil in 30 years, you'd build a million barrels a day or two every year of new coal to liquids facilities, and those coal to liquids facilities have roughly double the life cycle CO2 emissions of conventional oil because you're taking a high carbon fuel and making a lower carbon fuel. So, and there's just no shortage of coal, in my opinion. Now, there are some people who really believe in peak oil, but I think they're a fringe.
I want to go back to the plants issue. If you have these particles up there, there's quite a lot of blue light, and plants like blue light a lot. So would you say that the sun is going to shine less? It's going to shine a lot less where it matters. So.
Well, so for plants actually have two absorbing bands. That's why it looks green, right?
Yeah, I know.
And they have it. Yeah, correct. So first of all, it depends how small it is, whether you're really getting me scattering small particles or not. And also it depends on this issue about saturation, so that if you have more diffuse blue, you may end up getting faster growth because leaves aren't so shadowed, so not as many of them are saturated. In principle, if you build something like the kind of, admittedly kind of wacky thing I'm talking about, where you make these little platelets, you can adjust, so you can choose to make an aluminum layer, then you're not me scattering anymore. It's just you've got a cutoff based on electron density, and that's a completely different spectral character. And in principle, you could do more complicated things and actually tailor the thing to remove some piece of sunlight. In principle, you could tailor it to remove sunlight that wasn't in photosynthetic bands. And, Lowell Wood will tell you that we should just do that wholesale, and so we should go for a world that has 1,000 ppm CO2 to stimulate plant growth, where we then just adjust down the amount of sunlight. I mean, Lowell Wood likes to antagonize liberals, but that's what he'll say, and there's nothing physically impossible about doing that. I don't think it's very likely it would actually be done. I'm not a plant physiologist, obviously. There have now been a couple studies that have used modern ecosystem models to look at this effect, and the results are mixed. I can show you what the studies are.
Yeah. But in talking about temperature, you're really talking about the transfer of not just radiation. I think there are companies that also change the convection, the radiation, the heat transfer from the surface. And I was just wondering, has anyone been looking into the overall heat transfer problem rather than simply the radiation?
not sure I understand. So, I mean, the Earth is heated. The way to think about the Earth is it's a fluid heated from the bottom. Sunlight comes in, warms the bottom, and then there's convection that takes you up. And understood. Right. So, well, it's convection, both moist and dry convection. But maybe I'm not sure what your question is still. What could you modify about that? Well, so people, there was a time where weather control was a big focus of national R&D programs in the atmospheric sciences. And during those days, people looked at ways to control evaporation, and so evaporative heat transport, either by, so there's a bunch of that stuff that was done. You may know this stuff. And I think that I don't know any of that has this kind of leverage. I mean, it's true that humans, by moving as much water around the planet as they do and altering river courses, do alter local climates through changing water availability and therefore the amount of heat which is lost by dry heat as opposed to moist. So I briefly quipped that it wasn't necessarily better to have long-lived particles. And indeed, if you were doing this, if you think about this as a control under uncertainty problem, you'd actually probably like to start with really short-lived particles and push the system a little bit to see what the response was, both the chemical response and climate response. And only once you had some confidence it was doing what you wanted would you put them in more. So I think the answer is actually, it's probably, I'm being pretty glib about how you would actually manufacture these things, which we've just started to think about seriously, and about anything about how they would live in the atmosphere. So if you're at 100 kilometers, you've actually got a lot of atomic oxygen, and you've got a lot of hard UV. And so actually making something last a long time up there is not necessarily easy. I think it would probably be harder to make them live a long time than it would be. I mean, if you wanted to design one of these things to oxidize quickly so it had a lifetime by oxidation of a year, I think that would be easy. The hard part might be making one that would actually last 10 years. So I think the answer is there are potentially ways around that. But it's the right question, because you don't actually want something that stays there for good. That's a horrific thing.
Okay. Well, since we're at 5, were there any other urgent questions? Because we need to be up front for a little bit. Okay, yeah. One, someone else.
This is not directly related, but what's the contribution of raising cattle for meat rather than eating more vegetables?
On methane? As a fraction of the total human contribution to climate change?
Yeah.
First of all, cars are relatively small. So in Canada, despite all you hear about, cars are 16 or so percent of the emissions, smaller than you might think. And I don't know what cattle are. In Canada, they'd be bigger because we probably make more meat than we eat. But it's smaller than cars by factors of 2 or 3. Methane, there's been several attempts, one by a really smart atmospheric scientist, to try and calculate what your personal greenhouse gas footprint is if you drive a big car compared to eating meat. And those are, no, but seriously, one of these, there's published papers now looking at this, and the answer is it's actually similar contribution, the difference between a big and a small car and eating meat or not. But those life cycle calculations have big error bars. Actually, Alex, you might know the answer to that question better than me, wherever Alex is. One over there?
Okay, yeah, sure.
I guess your fourth point on one slide was that scientists have to consider that we won't control these technologies forever.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could comment on possible concerns, for example, different countries having different ideas of what climate they're targeting, maybe each releasing different things.
Well, so this is a serious and realistic concern, I think. The problem is we typically think, when I talk about something like this, you might think this is an incredibly high-tech and expensive thing to do, and it's only in the range of the most powerful nations on Earth. That's not clear. The cost of putting materials in the stratosphere is sufficiently cheap that at least for some of these things, it's conceivably in the range of the richest human beings on Earth. And you could imagine small nations doing this that have less effective decision-making processes than the big nations, not don't want to overstate that on a day like this. But and you could imagine nations that felt threatened doing it quickly. So actually, while you naturally think of this, maybe the U.S. is going to do it. In fact, a scenario might be that Bangladesh does it if they decide they're really going to go under. And they say to the rest of the world, we're having all these meetings about climate change, nothing is really happening. You know, let's just get on with it and do something. And that then you might have international arguments, disputes, even war about where the thermostat should be set. Well, you know, a sort of analogy is to think of, you know, frat boy sharing an apartment pushing the thermostat up and down. We had a meeting that one of my colleagues organized at the Council of Foreign Relations, the kind of elite U.S. foreign policy body, about 8 months ago or something, I forget, it was this year, to talk about just that, where we had a bunch of the kind of elite foreign policy and nuclear weapons community and people who've thought about this, including Ralph Cicerone, who's the head of the U.S. National Academy, who's quite thoughtful on this topic and keen to get some real research done. And one of the issues is how to think about successful control regimes elsewhere. So the community that does genetic engineering actually had a kind of self-policing strategy about how they would roll out this technology. It grew out of a workshop, I believe, at Asilomar in the early 70s, where there were essentially the early community of people doing gene transfer agreed on protocols for how to do it. And there are other examples of, like, no first use of nuclear weapons, where there have been things that weren't quite treaties but were international norms of behavior that have had some role, however imperfect, in shaping behavior. And so part of the point of that meeting was to get people talking in the international relations community about whether we should look for some norm of behavior. The problem is humans don't do very well when you just drop a new technology on the table and let people figure out what the heck to do, and it's good to start thinking about how you control that technology before you actually have it. So those conversations are started. That doesn't mean there's not a problem, but people whose job it is to do this stuff are at least beginning to think about what the international norms for testing would be, for example. So I guess I can say this now. The Russians were serious. The Russians have long had a strain of Russian geophysicists who are very keen on this technology, going back to Bodiko. And some of them are still quite powerful in the Russian government, and they were keen enough to actually push through to Putin and want to get geoengineering on a G8 summit. Most sane people think that that would be a terrible idea, because this is a field that is really not ripe for any serious conversation. We're just beginning to have serious conversations, and so there was a deal made to get that off the table. But that has begun some international conversations about this, because there are people who actually want to do tests quite soon. I don't think they're very serious people, but there are people. And so one of the issues that I and other people are working on is how we could have a research program that actually began to do this in a more sane way, where to me, sane would mean, you know, a lot of model studies and a lot of work focused on all the things that could go wrong before you ever tested anything.
Yeah, I'm going to indulge myself in a comment.
All right.
But I mean, this last point is really important about, you know, ways of testing this, field testing any of these ideas is a real challenge. And the past experience with, say, weather modification studies where they try cloud seeding and trying to get very short time scales.
Yeah.
So you think you have great observations.
Yeah.
Compared to the climate problem, I mean, you think that would be easy, and yet it's been very hard to get any really robust signals in field studies for cloud seeding on a consistent basis. And so I think it's a real challenge to really test this stuff outside of models and in the field.
Let's distinguish two kinds of testing. So I think doing tests that looked at local atmospheric chemistry, you could do.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I worked on atmospheric chemistry instruments, I worked on instruments for the NASA, what you call it, U-2 or ER-2 aircraft, and we successfully, not me personally, but other people in Jim Anderson's group, at one point they flew the ER-2 pilot, agreed with a Concorde pilot to fly through the Concorde exhaust plume, and we were able, because we had all the instruments, to actually get all the ratios, even though we didn't know what fraction of the plume we hit, we were able to get the entire data we needed to understand, say, NOx production of the Concorde engines. And you could imagine doing experiments quite easily where you got the U-2 and you released a puff of particles and then flew back through them a bunch of times if you had a tracer and you could do ratios and you could detect atmospheric chemistry effects. That you could do. What is not clear is whether you could do anything meaningful on climate short of a test that was really quite big. I mean, that is one that would be several tens of percent of 2x CO2. And that's something you and I have talked about doing, but I think it's very, very unclear. On a computer, yes. Yeah. Sorry, I talked about the signal-to-noise calculations. It would be, I mean, this is a bunch of what got talked about, this workshop that happened in Santa Barbara this summer that had probably one of the most serious workshops that people thinking about this yet, was whether you could introduce perturbations, how big they'd have to be to see them above the background noise. And I think the answer is nobody's thought about this very carefully yet.
Okay, so I'll close it then, and let's thank David again.
Thanks. Welcome.
So
thanks.
I'm pretty sure there'll be a fair amount of time. Let's say, why don't we say...
What do you call it? You've got